Thank you very much. Well, actually, my talk is going to be extremely short because John Waldron has already given it. And some of it we'll be just going through, and it was largely correct. Well, almost entirely, actually. Yes, it reminded me of this time we both went to the Colgate conference and our walk. There were two memorable events. The rattlesnake, which he mentioned, what he didn't say was that the idea was we would bash it and dispose of it, but it was considered to be so big that we thought we'd just leave it alone and walk on. But the other memorable event was on our way back. I think we may have taken a ferry trip to forget where it was, but anyway, we left my luggage in the luggage store of the ferry. We got back and found it was all closed up, closed at 5. That was my luggage, and we were going on a flight in a couple of hours. Well, we did what you do in Britain, asked the policeman for help, but policemen in the US are not as helpful as in the UK. Anyway, what happened was that I kept guard while John went back and he found an unlocked door and retrieved my luggage. So I was able to fly back with it rather than leaving it in the States. Okay, a thing which I think we can get it later, but this talk of Bardeen reminded me of a cartoon in Physics Today. I think we can probably find it on the internet, so we'll be able to show it later, which shows Bardeen standing in front of a tunnel saying, blocking my path. So we'll see if we can find out on the internet to show you it later. Well, what's new first? Well, first of all, I thought when John was talking about anniversaries, he was going to say, and the other anniversary today is Alan Turing. It's 100 years since Turing's birth. He was born on June the 23rd, so therefore I'm wearing this in his honour. In fact, there are various similarities between our careers. One is that he was a martyr, obviously not for the same reasons as me. And at least I was not a martyr for the reasons that he was a martyr. Also, his work was a lot of his work was unknown. In his case, it was secrecy. In the other case, it was I think the groupthink effect, that if everybody thinks X. If 90% of people think X, then you think X must be correct. Well, unfortunately, in my case, there have been the 10% who have been interested in my later work. Let's see if this will... I talked about my present work yesterday. I think this is actually more important than the superconductivity work, and we have things more or less sorted out, and just has to be turned into a paper now. But this is Fatini Palakali, who may be here. She drew this cartoon back in 1991, showing science advancing from quantum physics to physics in which the mind is taken into account. But I talked about that yesterday, and with luck, it was recorded well enough that I can put the talk on the internet. Just to talk about my rocky path after discovery, I'm only going to talk briefly about this. I was approached by Oleg Balkashin, who is the editor of the Russian journal Fizhika Nikhi Tetratura, which is the Russian language journal of temperature physics, and to ask if I would write something for it. And I said, well, can I be a little broader and talk about my career? And this is the my abstract, the events leading to discovery of superconductivity, positive predictors, authors move to a perspective where mind plays a role comparable to matter, and the remarkable hostility sometimes encountered by those who venture into unconventional areas. I'm just going to go quickly through these. There's this bizarre email I received, which some of you may know about. It's come to my attention, it's interesting, kind of normal. In my view, it would not be appropriate for someone with such interest to attend a scientific conference, so my invitation was suddenly withdrawn. It got to the extent of asking me how long I wanted to talk for, but anyway. But actually, it was a very technical conference, so I'm glad I didn't go. Here's an article. This is a response to my, when I took the opportunity to use the, I was asked to write something for the Nobel Century Scenery Stamps, and I, at the end of it, the person doing it said, would you like to be a little bolder and think about the future? I mentioned how Britain was doing so well in telepathy research, and this was something appeared in the Observer. Well, I just think this indicates something about the intellectual ability of who did it, because people have not really looked at what had been done. Yes. More serious things are things we actually block research. This is my recent paper, which was an early version of the talk I gave yesterday. I think this is serious because one of the aims of the preprint archive is the original aim was communication of people's ideas to others. So they actually stopped quantum physicists seeing that paper. Now, it's quite true that for most people this would have no interest, but it's built upon Wheeler's ideas on observer participation, and I think it could have been picked up by somebody, but there's no arguing with the secretive censors of the archive. I had some support in Nature. At some point they published this, and there was one person who was so supportive, the person in charge of Nature, let us that he actually held back the letter until they could give it pride of place as the first one. Radical changes are required in the way the archive is administered. So that hasn't happened yet. Still more serious, this was from an MPhil thesis of my student Osborne. He made a computer simulation an idea similar to what those were working on, the idea of a hyperstructure, and this was the mathematics he based his simulation on. This was fairly instructive, but the powers that be who couldn't understand the mathematics, the word mathematical obfuscation was used, which might have been the case if the mathematics came after the simulation, but it was the basis of the simulation. So this is actually blocked, and that's, I think, my present work might have worked out better had this computer simulation line been able to go. Okay, so now back to what I'm supposed to be doing, repeating John Waldron's journey. Okay, well, let me say first one thing. My move from, as John correctly said, I switched to applied mathematics in my second year because I got better marks. I later realised that this was because applied mathematics questions can be churned out by a kind of automatic process as long as you understand everything. And whereas it's not the case for pure mathematics, you have to be creative to solve a pure mathematics question. But anyway, the actual thing was in school I had some very helpful schoolmasters. A physics master, M.S. Jones, lent me a book by Yost, Theoretical Physics. So I got amazed by things that you could actually calculate the properties of substances, like calculate the physics of heat. There's a theory from which you could calculate everything. So that made me interested in theoretical physics, and I wasn't getting it from the applied mathematics, which dealt with things like images of electrical charges and all the basic stuff. So I did change to physics. I remember reading at some point, I suppose researching, I remember sitting in the university library studying, I believe it was a book by Wenzel on quantum field theory. So I was asked by David Schoenberg, can you try and understand this BCS theory? Not only that, there was a very obscure book by Bogoliubov and two other Russian authors called A New Method in the Theory of Superconductivity, which used these quasi-particle operators for superconductors. But I was particularly interested in the question of the phase. Now, just to correct the point of history, it's often seems to be thought that it was Anderson's lectures which were my stimulation, but actually it was a paper he published, which I think I already knew about, Anderson's pseudo-spins. There were a lot of papers at the time indicating that phase appeared. I think I have a diagram. Yeah, this is Anderson's broken symmetry idea. Well, I'll get back to that in a moment. The Ginzburg Landau theory had a complex wave function, so a phase appeared there. Gotthoff theory was a fundamental justification of the Gotthoff theory. Gotthoff theory was just inspired equations with a superconducting wave function. Gotthoff theory justified this, that had a phase. So my thought was, well, the reason this phase is the reason why you can have supercurrents, because if a phase changes from one place to another, this tells the electrons which way to go. Furthermore, if you were to make a loop and you had a phase change with a multiple of 2 pi going around that loop, then that could give you persistent currents, because once you've got this phase change around the loop, you can't change it without doing anything drastic. So that is conserved, and that makes the currents go around in a particular way. So that was how I got into phases in superconductivity. As John said, Graver's paper came out. Graver didn't bother about niceties like coherence theory, coherence factors. When Pippard came to me and said, this is a fishy argument, isn't it? And I thought, well, these phases should alter the coherence factors, because the coherence factors are sum of 2 interfering terms, and if you made a phase difference, you would that would alter the coherence factors, and perhaps things would average out to 0. So what I expected then was that I think it's already clear, and maybe even in Gorkov's paper, I think there was a time factor depending on the chemical potential. So if you had a voltage difference, these coherence factors would oscillate and average out to the to unity. So what I expected then was an oscillating current at a finite voltage, which is actually not much smaller than the actual current. Okay, so then I think next thing was Anderson coming along with telling me about, very excited about this theory. I think I just mentioned about the Anderson paper, his version of phase, where he did something called the random phase approximation, and you got pseudo spins in it. In normal state, these pseudo spins, I think they only had one component, and they changed from up to down when you went through the Fermi surface. But you had extra terms because of broken symmetry. This meant that the spins were off at an angle, and the plane, they were all in the plane though, and that plane could have different orientations, so that gave the equivalence of a phase. I also thought about magnets being analogous. This is a thing which is mentioned in my fellowship dissertation at Trinity. It occurs to me that perhaps we should get that scanned and put on the internet. But I did, however, write, a book by, what occasion was it? At least there was certainly a book where I wrote a chapter which had probably had most of the ideas in it. I did take magnets as an analogy, because a magnet's got a plane, and if there are 2 magnets, then the phase difference means something. But by symmetry, it doesn't matter which way your magnet is pointing, but if you've got 2 magnets, the phase relationship is physically significant. And so I got to the idea of general principles that only the relative phase would have physical significance. Also, there's a gauge symmetry argument which showed you actually have to transfer electrons to be able to get any physical significance. So I wondered about this, and I suppose Graver's experiment indicated how this might happen. I wasn't sure where to take this, but when this paper of Cohen, Falikoff and Phillips came out, I realised I could apply this method. Now, it turns out I was lucky. They may have got the Nobel Prize instead, but the paper talks only about the case where one of the sides is superconducting. Falikov was asked to go away and consider a two superconductor case, and he reported back. There are these funny terms here, can't figure out what they mean. And they said, oh, we'll leave that out. We'll just publish the normal superconductor case, because that shows that the justified gave us a result. So they didn't publish it, but I did. It was published in Physics Letters because Brian Pibbard wanted to support this new venture, and he perhaps didn't like brash American journals, I don't know. then Bardi and Moonwell, about the same time, Bardeen had submitted a paper, not sure what it was about, but he had seen my paper and took it upon himself to insert a footnote saying that my calculation was wrong because coherence didn't extend across the barrier. However, if you considered just the calculation showed that if you assumed a tunneling Hamiltonian, then it would superconducting coherence across the barrier didn't matter. As John said, I was asked if I would go and debate with Bardeen at the 9th Low Temperature Conference in Queen Mary College, which I did. I rudely interrupted Bardeen at the point in his lecture where I thought he got it wrong. But anyway, I was 22 at the time. So I had my say at the end, and I believe it was Dejeune. I didn't know him at the time, but I think it must have been him. And he had done some work on this, I believe, and he went up and defended me. And of course, Anderson defended me in the lab. People were rather sceptical, and Anderson said, no, Josephson is right. What else happened? Various things fell out. Brian Pippard appreciated the importance of the current voltage relationship of the AC supercurrent, that it might be important, so this was put in at the end. Maybe Anderson recognised that the phase, the effect of magnetic field upon phase, which you get from the Ginsburg-Landau equations, would mean you could get interference. I think he may have published something, but there was an error in his paper. It was corrected before it came out because I said it's wrong. He he knew it depended on enclosed flux, but he thought it would only be enclosed flux in the barrier, whereas I considered it would be flux in the penetration region as well. But anyway, that made it much more sensitive to magnetic field than it would have been if Anderson's theory had been correct. As John said, we tried to verify this. In fact, John Adkins, he assisted with this. I think we'd heard that there was some glow discharge technology to make tunnel junctions better. Our mistake was trying to get the perfect experiment with barriers which were so thick that there couldn't be leaks, that proved our undoing, because what we didn't realise, and which I think Anderson was the person who realised this, is that room temperature noise could disrupt the experiment, because the leads to your apparatus would send room temperature noise down to it, and I'd been able to convince myself that the noise at low temperature shouldn't be able to disrupt the phases enough to disrupt the effects. But in fact, because of this noise going down the leads to the experiment, that did disrupt it. And our, I think it's aluminium oxide barriers, meant that the current was so small that it didn't work. Anderson and Rowell, however, and Rowell will be talking about this later, they used lead, I think, where there was a risk of shorts, but they more or less proved there weren't shorts by observing the magnetic field effect. I think I have some slides on this. I guess that's what I've already talked about. This was the equation, and this was the article on the web, calculation using the Hamiltonian method. I think it was actually published one by a factor 4 because I integrated from 0 to infinity instead of infinity minus infinity to infinity rather than the other way about. And so Ambigalko and Baratov thought they'd got the correct calculation, but in fact it was my error. They thought they'd found something new, but we actually both came out with the same result. I saw this thing and wondered whether that was it. We don't know. I think John mentioned this. We did, when you have a current less than 1 nanoamps, we did try compensating magnetic field to make sure there was a high temperature experiments going on, high magnetic field experiments going on next door while we were doing low magnetic field experiments, compensating out the Earth's magnetic field. Who was our host in Lake George, and wherever we met the rattlesnake, he did this experiment with a nice sin x over x dependence on the magnetic field, the interference thing. Time-dependent effects, which had the various applications, the constants measurement, standardizing voltage, and so on. Factor uses, well, you'll be hearing all about the factor uses and squids. So I think I'll finish there. This is painting by Carol Josephson, 27, as you'll see. So finish there. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Brian? 2 minutes.
Is your daughter in there?
No, my wife. You can identify her by the equation on the back of the T-shirt. I remember I think we'd arrived at Washington for a conference, and there was a chap offering to put letters on the back of a T-shirt, and I explained to him how you could make a delta out of 3 I's and a phi out of an O and an I.
When did you first read Gorkov? Was it just reading around, or were you pointed to it?
Maybe through David Schoenberg. And he had translated Ginsberg and Landau, of course, yes. So I read that.
I don't think I heard about Gorkov until the following years.
Yeah. Not too sure. Maybe by Anderson, but I don't really recall those details.
Yes?
When Dunbarbine figured out that you were right, did he call you or contact you?
I think he announced it at the Colgate conference. He gave a speech where he said I was wrong about this. I know. He actually modified his... I think when the currents were observed, he modified his theory. He added an extra term, but that was still wrong. It was a question of power of the matrix element. We thought it wouldn't happen at all. My calculation showed it would. So Bardeen fixed his with a 4/3 power, sticking in some extra energies. But he, at the Colgate conference, he was giving a speech for something and admitted that he got it wrong and my calculation was right. Of course, in those days, we didn't have email.
Yes.
Can I ask how you found out that Rowell and Anderson had in fact claimed to see the effect that you described?
Well, they did actually use either a telephone or snail mail to tell me.
Was this a surprise, or did you think, yeah, sure?
Well, I think we were wondering, is this a real thing or just a sort of, some calculations don't correspond to reality. And we were, after we found there was no current down to 1 nanoamp, we're wondering whether it was real. So I was very pleased to hear that they had measured it. Quite. What Anderson did in the experiment, I don't know. I think his main contribution was persuading John Rowell. Well, actually, maybe John can explain.
If there are no more questions, let's thank Brian again.